This is the Stella Culinary School Podcast, episode 22. Let's bake some sourdough. Hello and welcome to the Stella Culinary School Podcast. In this episode, we'll be talking all about sourdough bread baking. Last episode, we talked about sourdough starters and pre-ferments. In this episode, we're going to actually look at how to take those pre-ferments, take those starters, and turn them into some amazing sourdough bread that you can bake in your home or in your restaurant. And honestly, it's really not that hard. So take out your chef coats and aprons. It's time to go to class. And this is the Stella Culinary School Podcast, found online at stellaculinary.com. My name is Jacob Burton. Thanks so much for joining me in this, our last episode in our epic bread series. Oh, it's kind of sad, but man, we've come a long way. I mean, if you've listened to the entire series, we've really learned a lot about bread together, some amazing fundamentals, and some more advanced techniques building all the way up into this, our sourdough bread baking audio podcast, the long-awaited audio podcast on sourdough bread baking, because this is like the holy grail of bread baking. This is what every baker wants to be able to do. They want to be able to make an awesome artisan loaf of sourdough bread. And not everyone can do it. And it has nothing to do with this born talent, okay? Let's get that out of your head right now. Everyone can do it, but everyone isn't capable of taking the path to doing it. Does that make sense? Because it's all knowledge. It's all just training. And look, when you're doing an advanced concept like baking sourdough bread, you're not going to knock it out of the park the first time. It's just not going to happen. All right. But what you need is the fundamentals of bread baking, which we've already covered in our past episode. So press that pause button right now if you haven't heard those, because this will lose you. You will be lost in this episode if you have not listened to our previous podcasts. But if you have, then get ready for a ride, because we're going to talk some sourdough bread. Now, if it's such a pain to make sourdough bread, why even bother, right? I get comments like that sometimes, especially on YouTube. Those guys aren't that nice over on YouTube. They're kind of mean sometimes, like little trolls underneath the bridge, poking at me and prodding me. I'm like, hey, why do you want to spend so much time baking bread? Isn't that why bread bakeries were made? Well, yeah, you can go to a bread bakery and buy your own bread, but nothing really beats a fresh-made loaf of sourdough that has, you know, it's made by your hands. You've created the starter, you've nurtured the starter, you've brought it through its life cycle, and you made it a great loaf of sourdough bread. I mean, there's something very, very rewarding about it, and I feel bad for people who don't get it. I'm not saying everyone has to be able to bake sourdough bread, but there's something very rewarding about the time and effort and love that goes into making a great loaf of sourdough bread. And quite frankly, not everyone has access to a good bakery in their town or within good driving distance or wherever you are. And when you go to your local supermarket, unfortunately, some of your choices on bread are limited. I mean, they try and replicate, you know, they have like their little like artisan baguettes, but look, we know where those came from. They came from the back of a freezer truck and some dude popped them in the oven this morning. Now, they're not horrible, but they're just not awesome artisan hearth breads made with a natural sourdough starter coming fresh from your oven. But they're not nearly as bad as that sliced cake that just lines your supermarket aisle. You go to down your bread aisle, it's all sliced cake, right? With maybe a baguette here or there, and you take home and you slice it yourself. I mean, you look at the sliced quote-unquote sandwich bread that's so popular in supermarkets, and you see that evenly brown top. You know, there's no colored gradient. It's just a smooth brown color. That's due to added sugars in the dough and a very low temp cooking environment where they're baking it a lot like a cake. It's batter-based bread. It makes it rise faster. And it has no character because of this. The crust is flimsy and thin. It has no texture. Because the water content is so high, the crumb is spongy and like gummy. You know, when you chew on it, like it sticks to the back of your teeth and the roof of your mouth. You got to stick your finger in your mouth and scrape the roof of your mouth. It's horrible, right? It's sliced cake. And look, I'm not here to judge you. If you want to stick some salami between two slices of cake with some mayo and mustard, have at it. No problemo, okay? But let's just be honest about what it is. It's not an artisan loaf of bread, right? There's nothing wrong with it. It's just not amazing sourdough hearth bread, which I'm going to teach you how to make in this episode. In contrast to this cakey bread that has no flavor and aroma is the beautiful artisan style of hearth-baked sourdough. It's amazing, amazing stuff. Right, I mean, you look at the crust. I mean, immediately, when you look at the crust of a sourdough leavened or a naturally leavened dough, when it comes out of a hot hearth oven, the crust itself is just eye-poppingly beautiful. It's not this even light brown color. The color ranges from light tan where the crust ruptured and expanded perfectly because that's where the baker told it to rupture by taking his razor blade and scoring the top of the loaf, or what we call docking, and telling the loaf, hey, expand here. And from those expansion marks outward, you get a gradient of rich golden brown with blisters of dark, dark brown, almost approaching black. And this can only be achieved by using the high heat of a hearth oven. And I keep on saying hearth oven, which is basically an oven lined with stone. Now, stop it. Take your finger away from that pause button. Okay, don't delete this. I'm going to tell you how to recreate this in your home oven. Okay. And you use it by recreating the environment in which bread is baked in a hearth oven. So we'll recreate this later on in our technique segment. But it's because of this high temperature that the crust is so beautiful. And it's because of the sourdough starter or the natural sourdough that you use to leaven this loaf that crust is even possible in the first place. See, when we talk, let me sidetrack here for a second, just real quick, okay? We've talked in the past in like our cooking technique audio lectures about the Maillard reaction. It's basically the reaction that allows things to brown, right? You brown food because it's yummy. You have this complex reaction that goes on. I'd rather eat a beautifully seared and brown steak than a steak that's been, you know, simmered in water, okay? Now, the Maillard reaction is a chemical reaction, and it's caused by both heat and also pH, right? So think of it as a scale of the more alkaline a object is, or the higher the pH a food item is, the lower the temperature it needs to be for the Maillard reaction to take place. So when you have a fairly neutral thing like bread dough, when you're using like commercial yeast, then browning can happen at a much lower temperature and burning will happen a lot quicker. So if you try to bake a commercially leavened, meaning you're using commercial yeast, you're trying to bake that loaf in a hot hearth oven, the exterior is going to burn before the interior is finished baking. Now, sourdough starter, well, what's a sourdough? It's acidic. It has acidic and lactic acid in it, and it has a lower pH. So when you leaven your bread with a sourdough starter that contains more acid, it has a lower pH than that commercial stuff, and you're able to bake it at a much higher temperature. And this higher temperature allows it to brown better, in very simple terms. But that's how you get that beautiful gradient browning where you have that light tan from the expansion marks all the way up to the dark little, very dark brown bits. Now, the crumb in a good artisan loaf of sourdough isn't this, you know, dense, cakey texture. It's open and airy and has irregular air pockets dispersed throughout the entire crumb. The texture is springy, and it can actually stand up to chewing. It doesn't stick to the back of your teeth, and you have to pick it out with your fingers, right? It actually, it can hold up to being chewed in your mouth, which is always nice. It makes great, great sandwich bread if you slice it. And the smell is complex aromas of the toasted wheat and floral and acidic notes. They're produced by the alcohol and the acid and the natural yeast present in the dough. And the taste is not neutral like your sliced cake bread. It's going to have a slightly sour, acidic taste, and the crust will be a little bitter, but in a good way. And that bitterness is caused from the deep, rich golden brown color that can only be achieved through high heat baking. And you can only do high heat baking with a naturally leavened loaf of sourdough, right? Also, the bread is better for you. Nutritionally, it's more healthy. The yeast and bacteria from the sourdough starter will provide B vitamins and biotin. And biotin, by the way, is especially important for those of you who are following a vegan or vegetarian diet, bacon. But for real, right? You need your B vitamins and biotin. And naturally leavened loaves of bread contain more of that. Also, if the bread contains whole grain flour, like whole wheat and rye, the soluble and insoluble fiber in the bran will help to control the absorption of fat and cholesterol, and that's going to help reduce the rate at which sugars are absorbed after a meal, which means you're not going to get those big hunger spikes, right? When you eat white bread from the store, like white sliced bread from the store, that's pretty much just a sugar bread, right? And so when you eat that stuff, it will spike. It'll give you a hunger spike after a while because it's like eating a big bowl of sugar almost, right, as far as your body's concerned. So it doesn't digest slowly. It digests quickly. It spikes your insulin, which spikes your hunger. And then a couple hours later, you're like, man, I'm hungry again. What the hell's going on? Well, that's why. Okay, so when you have a little bit of whole wheat in there, it gives it both flavor and also it digests slower. And you have some good dietary fiber. And also, too, natural fermentation will pre-digest some of the bran, so its minerals and vitamins are more available for absorption when you actually eat it. What happens is when you at these commercial bread factories that produce the sliced cake loaves, they produce the bread so quickly that a lot of the minerals that are already kind of bleached out of the flour, but a lot of the nutrients that would normally be more available to you don't have a chance to be made available by fermentation because the process happens so quick. They just put in a bunch of yeast, they whip a bunch of air into it, they basically turn it into a batter, and they shoot it on down the production line. Also, too, that whole wheat bread that you buy when you're on your health kicks, yeah, what a crock that is. Straight up, look at the back of the label on the whole wheat bread, okay? Check out the ingredients. You're going to see caramel color in it. Why? Well, because the whole wheat bread, even though they say 100% whole wheat, you know what that means? It means it's 100% whole wheat, as in like not half wheat or half wheat and half rice flour, right? Half wheat and half cornstarch. So the FDA doesn't really care as long as you're using all wheat in a bread, whether it's white flour or wheat flour, as in whole wheat flour, the FDA does not differentiate. So if any of you have ever tried to actually make 100% whole wheat bread in your home, you'll know that you've always had difficulties with it coming out dense, right? It's not very good sandwich bread because it's just extremely dense stuff because of the bran in it. It actually weighs it down. So what they do is they'll take about, you know, they'll take maybe 90% bleached white flour. They add some oats to it for some flavor. They add some bran to it for some flavor to make it seem healthier than it is, give it sort of a little bit more of a denser texture. And then they add in some good old-fashioned caramel coloring, which makes it sweeter. You know, it's basically just caramelized sugar syrup. So it makes the loaf sweeter, which you know is more palatable to the undeveloped human palate. And it also gives it that dark color. And we look at it and we go, the color's darker. So there must be more whole wheat in it. And I know that whole wheat's healthier for me than white wheat. So, gee golly gosh, Bob, I think I'll get the whole wheat. And wow, why is my 100% whole wheat bread always so dense? And theirs isn't dense. Well, it's because technically it's not 100% whole wheat. My whole point to this rant, for lack of a better word, was to address why we bake sourdough bread, why we go through the process of baking bread in our homes, in our restaurants, because not only is it rewarding, but quite frankly, with a little bit of knowledge and a little bit of patience, you can be producing bread that is much, much better than you could ever possibly buy. So in today's discussion segment, I want to talk to you about sort of the geeky science behind training and developing your sourdough starter and making it do what you want it to do as far as taste and the loaf that it produces. So we're going to talk about some metabolic pathways and some fermentative processes, and I don't want you to get too, I mean, there's not going to be like a midterm on this stuff. But what I want to do is I want to use it to put it into perspective in your brain so you kind of understand the decisions that we as bakers make, especially in regards to how we store our sourdough starter, what we feed our sourdough starter, and some timing issues with the sourdough starters. Okay. So a lot of what I'm about to tell you was derived from a really good article by Deborah Wink over on The Fresh Loaf. I'm going to link to this in the show notes of this episode. So you go to stellacolony.com/SCS22, and you're going to have a link to this. So don't worry about taking down notes or whatever. Also, too, I'm just kind of giving you the cliff notes. Her article goes much more into depth and is extremely geeky in an awesome way, as only a geek could love. So you'll have that there as a resource. And also, too, thefreshloaf.com, really great bread form. It's a great place to go and read some stuff. So check them out if you haven't yet. There's a little plug. They got some really good information on there. So to understand how what you feed your sourdough starter and also the environment in which you keep your sourdough starter, to understand how that affects the flavor of your sourdough loaf, we first need to understand metabolic pathways. Now, don't you let your eyes glaze over now. I mean, you could be driving or walking your dog down the street, so you need to keep those eyes open. I don't want you to fall asleep, and that could end badly for you. But in the context of sourdough bread baking, you want to think of this as a flow chart, okay? So at the top of this chart, you have a sugar, which is derived from your flour. And the sugar is released by, you know, the milling process of making the flour and also some enzymatic reaction when the flour is actually hydrated. And so you have some sugars that are floating around in your flour. And think of that at the top of this, like, what's that, the Plinko game? Anyone watch, like, The Price is Right? I mean, I know it's a real, like, American reference. But they drop the little chip at the top, and it would come blink, 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 and it drops down, and you know where it pops out is where you how much money you win. But anyway, so think of this as like the Plinko game of sugars, okay? And so you drop a sugar in at the top, and it kind of bounces around through this metabolic pathway, and it's sort of an enzymatic chain reaction goes on. And there's some intermediate compounds made as it's bouncing around in this metabolic pathway, and then out the other end pops something. Okay, we'll talk about what that is in a second. But basically, just, you know, sugar in the top, metabolic pathway, it drops down and pops out the other side, something, right? Now, like all living things, microbes need energy to live, to grow, and to multiply, okay, just like us. So certain metabolic pathways will create more energy than others, just kind of like if we eat junk food, right, we're not going to have as much energy as if we eat healthy food. And so it's almost the same thing with what bacteria or microbes will selectively decide to eat, because really they're not self-destructive creatures like us, right? They're not going to abuse their life cycle. They're going to choose at any point when they have the ability to choose what's best for them to make the most energy. They're going to do that. Okay. Now in the world of yeast, the aerobic metabolic pathway, meaning that oxygen is available and used, will always produce more energy than any other anaerobic pathway in which the environment contains no oxygen. As far as bread dough is concerned, any oxygen that is incorporated into the dough during the mixing process is quickly used by the yeast through aerobic pathways. So it's used up very, very quickly. Now, lactic acid bacteria, which is part of your sourdough starter, so you have your wild yeast and you have your wild lactic acid bacteria that we talked about in the last episode, it doesn't have the ability to actually respirate. So it will only work in anaerobic environments. So what happens is you mix air into your dough just naturally during the kneading process. The natural yeast will quickly use up that air in aerobic fermentation. And then once it uses up that air, the yeast will switch to an anaerobic metabolic pathway or fermentation. And then the lactic acid bacteria kind of switches on and says, okay, cool, now there's no oxygen, now I can actually go to work and I can eat. So once the oxygen is used up, the yeast turns to an anaerobic pathway, meaning the oxygen is no longer involved in how they consume sugar for energy. And the byproducts that the yeast produce are popped out on the other side of the metabolic pathway. So to put this into perspective, let's look real quick at, you know, what we supply our bodies with energy, how we do that. We eat food, right? And it works its way through our system, being broken down and converted into various intermediate compounds that our body can use. And then it pops out the other side of our metabolic pathway as a byproduct. So yeast, when we're using commercial or wild, it doesn't really matter whether we're making bread, beer, or wine. They're very simple organisms. The yeast just eats sugar as their food, and they produce alcohol and CO2 as their byproducts. So the alcohol is what makes wine and beer possible, and the CO2 is the gas that allows bread to rise, both during fermentation and the baking process. Now, as I'm sure you can guess, as a baker, the simplicity of yeast, it's like the dumb organism of the microbe world, is very limiting to what we want to do as far as creating complexity of flavors in our dough. So because the byproducts created by lactic acid bacteria are much more varied than that of yeast, bakers can add more complexity to their bread by using a natural levain or sourdough starter. But being able to control the amount of acid and the types of acid produced by your natural levain is something that's very important to understand. It's kind of hard to grasp when you're first getting into sourdough baking. It leads to a lot of confusion. Like, why is my starter so sour? Why isn't my bread sour enough, right? All this has to do with how the metabolic pathways within your sourdough starter are functioning. So there's many different strains of lactic acid bacteria, or LAB for short. And depending upon what their preferred metabolic pathway is and the food made available to them in the form of flour that's fed to the starter, they're going to produce various byproducts that will affect your bread's flavor and texture. Now, the three main byproducts are carbon dioxide, which helps actually leaven your loaf, just like yeast, right? So lactic acid bacteria actually will produce carbon dioxide as well as yeast. The second byproduct is lactic acid, and the final one being acetic acid. Now, lactic acid is commonly found in dairy, and it's not a harsh acid. It's kind of almost like a sweet acid, if that makes sense. And it's going to give you a savory, milky aroma when it's present in your bread. Acetic acid, on the other hand, is the same acid found in vinegars and will give your bread that sour punch if you really want that sour loaf. Now, it's important to make sure that your lactic acid and acetic acid are produced in harmony by your starter to achieve the most complex and pleasing flavor. Now, also, it's important to note that acid will weaken gluten strands. So if you don't have your acetic acid production in check and you go a little too overboard with it and you don't know how to fix it, what's going to happen is the pH of your starter is going to be extremely low, and it's going to basically weaken that gluten structure to the point where it can't hold gas anymore. And you're going to get that underinflated loaf. You're going to have a hard time with that loaf rising. It's going to flatten out during the baking process, and you're going to have a denser loaf of bread. Now, like I just mentioned, there are many different strains of lactic acid bacteria, and depending upon how they actually ferment or metabolize sugars, they can be placed into three categories. You have homofermentative, heterofermentative, and facultative. Now, these terms might sound a little scary, but they're pretty self-explanatory if you stop to think about the prefixes, right? So the prefix homo means the same. So the homo-fermentative lactic acid bacteria will only produce lactic acid, right? It produces the same acid. Hetero means different. So a hetero-fermentative lactic acid bacteria is able to produce lactic acid, acetic acid, alcohol, or CO2 as a byproduct. Facultative means that the lactic acid bacteria isn't restricted just by one metabolic pathway. It can use either the heterofermentative metabolic pathway or the homofermentative pathway, depending upon what's available in the form of sugar, which leads us to the second part of our equation, which is the sugar itself. Because sugars are carbohydrates, carbohydrate, they're made up of carbon, which is composed of hydrogen and oxygen atoms, right? So depending upon the type of sugar we're talking about, the chain of carbon atoms can be various lengths, really. I mean, there's a whole wide world of carbohydrates out there. But the ones that concern us right now are the sugars common in bread fermentation, and those are the 5 and 6 carbon types. 5-carbon sugars are referred to as pentoses, and 6-carbon sugars are referred to as hexoses. Now, why is this important? Well, the reason why this is important is glucose and fructose are examples of hexoses, or 6-carbon sugars, while arbenose and xylose, also found in bread doughs and bread flours, are made up of 5-carbon atoms, making them pentoses. So, again, why does that matter? Well, homofermentative LAB, right, which produces all lactic acid, can only ferment 6-carbon sugars. Now there's the punchline, right? There's what we really glean from all that data. In the homofermentative pathway, the hexose sugar is split into 2 identical 3-carbon pieces, which are passed down through the reaction sequence and turn into 2 individual lactic acid molecules. So they can't produce acetic acid. Now, in comparison, heterolactic fermentation is based upon 5-carbon sugars, right? So pentosis may be used directly, although often what happens is a hexose is cut down by removing one of its carbons. So now it's, you know, a carbon is removed, now it has 5 carbons, so it's now a pentose or pentosis. The extra carbon is cast off in the form of carbon dioxide gas, so it's cast off as a byproduct, and the remaining 5-carbon molecule is split into 3 and 2-carbon units. Now, the 3-carbon piece is turned into lactic acid, and the 2-carbon piece will become either alcohol, basically ethanol, and acetic acid. So what does this mean to you as the baker? What this data tells us is the fact that what you feed your sourdough starter is going to influence heavily the lactic acid or acetic acid production. And here's why. The pentosis sugars are found largely in the bran of the wheat kernel, right? So we're talking whole wheat flour here. Also rye flours. So if you feed, now remember, even if you have a ton of homofermentative lactic acid bacteria in your starter, right? You got a huge, massive population of them. They can't break down pentosan sugars, okay? They can only break down hexose sugars, which you find in white flour. So what that means is if you feed your starter a lot of whole wheat flour, whole wheat rye, you're going to invigorate the lactic acid bacteria contained within your starter that can feed off of those sugars, which are the pentose sugars, and then produce acetic acid or the sour acid as a byproduct. Now, there's a lot of dogma around the location of a starter, right? You have like a San Francisco sourdough is famous, and you have other versions in the world that are famous. And what they talk about is, well, you have a certain bacteria and a certain yeast. And what we're starting to find is that's not really 100% accurate. What's going on here is you have various strains of wild yeast and various strains of lactic acid bacteria that live all over the world and that can be found all over the world and survive all over the world. However, in certain environments, some lactic acid bacteria and wild yeast strains will thrive better than others. All lactic acid bacteria enjoys warm weather, right? They're beach bums, really. They sit on the beach and they hang out in the sun. They enjoy it. So at about a 90 degree Fahrenheit room temperature is when both the lactic acid producing bacteria and the acetic acid producing bacteria are the happiest and they're most invigorated. As the temperature starts to drop, the homofermentative lactic acid bacteria that is responsible for producing only lactic acid, which makes your sourdough starter sweeter and less acidic tasting. Well, they don't like the cold. They're kind of wimps, right? So they start to just pout and go over in a corner and like, oh, it's cold. It's cold outside. I'm not going to work today. I'm going to stay home, right? And as the temperature continues to drop, so does their production rate. Now, also the production rate of acetic acid producing bacteria drops as well, but not nearly as fast as lactic acid bacteria. Now, at refrigeration temperatures, the homofermentative, again, the bacteria that produces lactic acid only, goes into full retreat and then just like, oh, it's cold in here, man. I'm just going to cover up under a blanket and just chill out for a while, you know? And it doesn't even really produce anything. It's almost in suspended animation. Whereas the heterofermentative bacteria and the facultative fermentative bacteria can still continue to produce. They can still eat the sugars at the top of that metabolic pathway and then produce byproducts at the other end, which is mainly at this point going to be acetic acid and alcohol. So that's why if you store your sourdough starter in your fridge for a long period of time and you pull it out, you'll notice it has a very strong smell of like raw vinegar and alcohol, and that's why. So what this means is if your sourdough starter is too sour, then you want to start trying to feed it some white flour that doesn't have any bran in it. So you want to get white bread flour and feed that into your starter with some, you know, a little bit warmer water maybe. And then let it ferment at room temperature for a couple of days and kind of keep on refreshing it. And that's going to get some of that acid out. Now, on the other hand, if your sourdough starter isn't quite acidic enough, if it's not really producing sour loaves, there's a couple more things you can do, a couple more steps, and we'll talk about that in our next segment when we talk about the actual technique of baking sourdough bread. But a couple of things that you can do is start feeding your sourdough starter rye flour or whole wheat flour, which is going to jumpstart the production by the heterofermentative lactic acid bacteria, creating more acetic acid. And then you, after you feed that starter the whole wheat, you kind of let it, you know, bubble away and get active at room temperature for maybe 2 to 3 hours, and then pop it in your refrigerator. And again, it's going to drop the temperature of the starter. The lactic acid producing bacteria are going to go to bed, right, and wake up when it's warmer. And the acetic acid bacteria are going to keep on working. They're going to produce the acetic acid, which is responsible for making your sourdough starter sour. Now, so you look at something like San Francisco, right? Look at what their climate is, what their environment is. San Francisco has a very mild climate. I mean, their average daily temperature is like 60 degrees, and it could be even colder depending upon what time of year it is and where you're at. If you're in a foggy part of the city, it stays extremely mild there. And so naturally, I mean, it's part of the tradition of sourdough starters in San Francisco. A lot of them will actually just by default feed a portion of their flour or a portion of the flour that they feed their starter is made up of whole wheat or rye, which helps to produce acetic acid. And then they leave it out at their room temperature, but their room temperature is like 60 to 65 degrees Fahrenheit. So you're going to have a more acidic sourdough starter in that environment, which means you're going to have more sour loaves that you produce. Now, let's contrast this to some guy who's baking sourdough bread in Hawaii, where his average room temperature is 70 to 85 degrees Fahrenheit, right? He's going to have more lactic acid produced in his starter, especially if he stores it at room temperature, and it's not ever going to be as sour as the sourdough loaf in San Francisco. But now that this guy in Hawaii who's listening, hey, Hawaii, what's up? Aloha, I guess. Now he knows that he can recreate that cold environment and produce more acetic acid by feeding his starter whole wheat or rye flour and then placing it in his fridge to drop the lactic acid production and up the acetic acid production. So now that you just got your brain completely smashed by geeky lactic acid bacteria fermentation stuff, let's talk about how to actually make a loaf of sourdough. So in today's technique segment, we're really going to get into how to make a sourdough loaf. I'm going to kind of give you the overview. Now, what I will say first is I actually have a couple of really nice videos for this at stellacaloria.com. So I'll put a link to those videos in the show notes if you have not seen them yet. So just kind of try and visualize along with me. But I'm not going to get too far into the technical details that are visual. Okay, I'm going to let you watch the videos for that. So I'm going to walk you through the step-by-step process of making a sourdough loaf of bread using our basic formulation, our basic recipe. But I'm going to talk more about sort of the mental landmines or the minds that you should have going in as far as what you should know, what you know to look for in certain stages. So first of all, let's talk about awakening your starter, because that's the most important thing. Now, if you've just started your sourdough starter, what's going to happen is you're going to be able to bake with it at about the anywhere from the 7 to 14 day mark. But really, the first loaf you'll actually be able to leaven will probably be at around day 10. Now, everyone's starter is different, but it just gives you a good idea. However, you're not going to realize any sort of complexity or sour flavor till at least day 30 with your starter. Okay, so just keep that in mind during this process. Now, even though your starter looks healthy and bubbly, it's important to make sure that it's strong enough to bake bread with before you actually mix your dough and go through and get your heart broken by your bread not rising properly. Now, the most surefire way to make sure that your starter is ready to bake with is the float test. And all you're doing is you're taking a room temperature glass or container of water that contains a few inches of water in it, drop a tablespoon of starter into it, and the starter should float. And what this is telling you is that there's enough carbon dioxide gas being produced by both the lactic acid bacteria and the wild yeast in your sourdough starter to actually leaven a loaf of bread. If your starter just drops or sinks to the bottom and doesn't float, then your starter just isn't strong enough to bake with. So either you need to let it ferment longer, you need to go through another feeding cycle, it's just too young, okay? And that's one of the biggest things that I get on the forum is I'll have people say, well, you know, I went through and I kind of passed the float test. It floated for like 5 seconds and then dropped to the bottom. And I baked with it and the loaf wasn't that good and it was dense and flat. You know, do you think that was the problem? And yeah, it was the problem. You know, that's you need a strong starter to successfully bake sourdough. Now, when you're taking your starter, well, let's look at two different scenarios, okay? The first scenario is removing your starter from suspended animation in your refrigerator and or using a starter that you have on an ongoing basis that you bake with pretty regularly, like every day or every few days. Okay, so when I talk about your starter being in suspended animation, I'm going to assume that you went through the instructions in episode 21 where I talk about how to actually make a sourdough starter, and you kept on feeding it till at least day 7 or 10, and you have a nice strong culture, right? And so you know you had a strong sourdough starter in the first place. Then life got busy, you didn't have time to make some bread, so you just gave it one final feed, you stuck it in the back of your fridge with the lid on the top, and you kind of forgot about it for a few weeks, okay? So now you just kind of have this soupy, sour, alcoholy smelling mess in the back of your fridge, and you want to bake with it. So you need to go through a couple refreshing cycles to reactivate the yeast and lactic acid bacteria cultures within your sourdough starter. So what you want to do is you want to remove your starter from the fridge, that's in suspended animation, and dump off half. And you're going to feed half back in. So again, when I say starter, we're talking purely about Poolish sourdough starters because that's what I told you to make in the last episode, and that's what I use, and that's what all my bread formulas are based upon, and that's what I recommend everyone else uses because it makes calculations so much easier. All right, so you have, say, 600 grams of starter in your fridge. You pour off 300 grams of starter. Well, you know, because you're using a 1-to-1 ratio by weight of flour and water, that technically you just poured off 150 grams flour and 150 grams water. Makes sense? So you feed that same amount back in. 150 grams water goes into the starter. 150 grams flour goes into the starter. You stir it in, and you let it hang out at room temperature for about 12 to 16 hours. Now, after that period of time has passed, it should be bubbly and should look active, but it's still not strong yet. If you try and get it to pass the float test, it's probably not going to happen. Now, if it does pass the float test, then rock on. You got, you know, some Arnold Schwarzenegger strength started going on there, so you can bake with it, but you're usually going to need to have 3 refreshments before you can actually bake with that starter. So again, after 12 to 16 hours, you pour off half, you feed half back in, let it hang out at room temperature, then you come back another 12 to 16 hours later, pour off half, feed back half, and now you have your third refreshment, and you allow this third refreshment to ferment for anywhere from 10 to 16 hours, or basically until it passes the float test. And it should be strong enough at that point to do this, to pass the float test. So go ahead and check it out. If it passes the float test, then you can move on to the mixing stage. Now, the question is, well, how much sourdough starter should I actually use in my bread formulation? And the answer is, well, it depends. I know, it's such a frustrating answer, right? But with bread in general, but specifically sourdough starter, it all depends upon what your desired outcome is, right? So if you were more specific and you said, well, how much sourdough starter do I need to mix into my dough so I can bake a loaf of sourdough bread today? Well, then that narrows it down. Because technically speaking, I can take, you know, 1 ounce of sourdough starter and leaven 100 pounds of bread dough with it, but it's going to take a long time, right? Because that yeast is going to have to double and quadruple and, you know, all the way on down the line until it produces enough of itself to actually leaven that loaf of bread. So in general terms, if I want to bake a same day loaf of sourdough, I'll make sure that 30% of my total flour in the bread dough recipe comes from the flour in my sourdough starter. So stay with me here. This really isn't that confusing. It's just kind of a confusing thing to explain. So if I had a standard bread dough recipe that does not use sourdough starter, it just uses commercial yeast, and let's just say it was, for sake of argument, let's just say it was 900 grams of flour to make this loaf of bread or this bread recipe. So I want 1/3 of that flour to come from my sourdough starter, which means, so to have 300 grams of flour come from my sourdough starter, how much starter would I need to add? Well, I would need to add 600, right? Does that make sense? So I take 300 away and I add 600 grams of starter because I know that starter contains, 300 grams of flour and 300 grams of water. So I'm subtracting that flour amount from my bread dough formulation, and then I'm also going to subtract that same amount from my water. So if my base recipe was 900 grams flour, 500 grams water, and then, you know, like a pinch of yeast and a pinch of salt, well, I would now have 600 grams flour, 600 grams starter, and 200 grams of water because I subtracted the 300 grams of the water in my starter from the 500 grams of water that I originally had. Okay, so this is just a rough outline, okay? And so also, too, this is why you need to make sure that you're controlling the life cycle and the flavor of your sourdough starter because you're adding a lot of the starter to it to make sure that you're baking bread within one day. And what this really means is you're looking at maybe a 3 to 4 hour bulk fermentation and a 2 to 3 hour proofing stage. Now, if you're unfamiliar with bulk fermentation and proofing, then hit pause now and go listen to our other podcasts because we cover it all there in depth. So it allows you, this ratio, it allows you to get the bread baked or the sourdough bread made within a day. Some people like to use less sourdough bread and extend that fermentation out over the course of, you know, 1, 2, 3 days total. But this is just going to give you a good basic loaf to make. So in our basic boule formula, we have 275 grams of warm water, 500 grams of poolish sourdough starter, 400 grams of bread flour, and 100 grams of whole wheat, and, you know, 20 grams salt. Now, don't worry about writing this down. I'm going to link to this in the show notes. But this just shows you that basically our flour and our starter amount is even in this formulation. And what that means is I can do a bulk fermentation in about 3 to 4 hours and a proofing in about 2 hours, bake the loaf, which takes me about anywhere from 30 minutes to 60 minutes, depending upon the size of the loaf. And so I've basically produced a nice, beautiful loaf of sourdough bread within 7 hours. Now, the process that I prefer for this is a little bit different than when I make my normal loaves of bread. What I like to do is I like to do an extended autolyse. And I don't actually show this in the bread video, in the basic sourdough bread video, because I didn't want to over-intimidate people because they're already pretty intimidated by it. So you can just mix and follow along with the recipe I give you in the video, and you're going to have really great results. Now, what I do at the restaurant, because we bake our bread daily with a sourdough starter in our wood fire oven, and we bake it right before dinner service. So I have this whole sort of method figured out for how we actually bake our daily bread. So what we do is the night before, we take the sourdough starter that we have, and we actually feed our sourdough starter twice a day because it's so active. So we take our container of room temperature sourdough starter, and we dump it all in the trash. And we only use what clings to the side of our sourdough container, because the sourdough starter is so active and so strong that it propagates extremely quickly. So we dump it all out, and then we feed back in equal amounts of flour and water. And I like to split it. I like to do half whole wheat and half bread flour, and then, you know, equal amounts of water to that back into our container. And by the time my morning bread baker comes in, who comes in and does the bread for us and gets it going, about, you know, he gets in about 5 o'clock in the morning. By about 6 o'clock in the morning, it's ready to mix a batch of dough with. And why we do this is because what this does is it gives us a young flavored starter. So it's more floral, it's less acidic. And the reason why I do that is because this bread is meant to go with all the dishes on my menu, right? We serve about 4 or 5 different types of bread at the restaurant in a bread basket. But if the bread is overly sour and they're eating this with a delicate glass of wine, or maybe they're eating it with a delicate scallop course, and they take a bite of like a really strong flavored sourdough bread, then it's going to throw off the flavor structure that I try to create for that dish in the first place, or the delicate flavor structure of the wine. So I don't want that. So I want the bread to be more universal, which is why we dump all the starter out the night before, and then we feed back in fresh flour and water. It gives us a more floral flavor. Now, if I wanted a more sour sourdough, I would dump off only half of my sourdough starter, and then when I feed the flour back in to my starter, I'm going to use whole wheat flour and cold water, because that's going to create acidic acid fermentation. And instead of fermenting it at room temperature overnight, I'm going to ferment it in my fridge overnight and kind of delay that fermentation, draw it out more, which is going to give me a more sour loaf. Now, when incorporating wheat flour, whole wheat flour, into your sourdough bread formulations, if you go above 20%, so if you have 1,000 grams of bread flour total in your formulation of your bread dough, and 200 grams is whole wheat and 800 grams is white bread flour, then you're going to be good to go. You're going to have a good whole wheat flavor without it affecting the texture. But as we talked about in our 4 pillars of bread episode, if you have too much whole wheat flour in your bread formulation and the magic threshold is about 20%, if you cross that threshold, then that whole bran is going to, which is jagged on a microscopic level, is going to start cutting into your gluten strands, shortening those gluten strands and giving you a more dense loaf. So you need to take into consideration, kind of keep track of how much whole wheat flour is in your starter, and then how much of that whole wheat flour makes it into your finished mixed loaf. If you have more than 20%, you're going to have issues with density. Now, can this be done? Yes, absolutely. With good technique and practice, you can bake 100% whole wheat loaves of bread that aren't inedibly dense, but they're always going to be much more dense than, just white bread flour. So again, if I want to make my bread more sour, I would produce more acidic acid by feeding it whole wheat flour and by chilling it and dropping the fermentation temperature. And then once you mix the dough together too, during either the bulk fermentation phase or the proofing phase, you can place that dough in your fridge for another retardation of the fermentation process, which again is going to draw out fermentation. It's going to allow more acidic acid to be produced, and it's going to give you a more sour loaf. And like I mentioned before in this podcast, if you produce too much acidic acid, it's going to weaken your gluten strands and you're going to get a flatter loaf. So it's always kind of a give and take sort of thing. So this is, this is the cool part of baking with sourdough is you understand this now. You understand you know, how to create acetic acid, how to create lactic acid, you know, how to delay fermentation, make your sourdough more sour. But if you take it too far, then and you have a flat loaf of bread that doesn't expand fast or have a good oven spring, you also know why. So you can start kind of tweaking in any one direction that you want to take it. Okay. So I got a little sidetracked there, but that's an important concept to understand. And if you didn't fully grasp that, you know, ask a question in the show notes or over on the Stellar Culinary Forum, because I really want you to get the concept of how temperature and what you feed your starter can affect the overall flavor of your sourdough bread. So when I mix my starter with my flour and water, I leave the salt out and I do an extended autolyse, right? And what this does is it allows the gluten structure to form, because I'm using about a 70% hydration dough here. So it's a little bit more hydration than what a normal bread recipe would call for. So I mix it together. I mix the flour, water, and sourdough starter together, leave the salt out for now, and let it autolyse for about 2 hours at room temperature. Now, this gives the lactic acid and the yeast in the sourdough starter sort of a head start on fermentation, and it also allows my gluten network to start to really develop a nice strong network without me having to knead it. Now, when I come back to my my bread dough, instead of kneading it the traditional method, what I'll do is a series of stretch and folds, usually at 20-minute intervals times three. So three stretch and folds spread out, you know, spread equally across an hour. So the first 2 hours is just I mix the dough together without the salt and I walk away. As soon as it's a shaggy mass, I don't even knead it. As long as I don't see any dry flour in the mixture, I just cover it with some plastic wrap so it doesn't dry out and I walk away. I come back 2 hours later, I add the salt in, and then I perform a stretch and fold. And what this means is I lay the bread out in front of me on a work surface. I don't use any sort of flour for this. I usually just hit my work surface with a little bit of nonstick spray. If the dough is giving you problems and it feels just really too moist to work with, then you can use a little bit of flour. It's not a big deal. It's not going to ruin anything. But eventually you want to work your way away from that, because the moister dough will yield a better finished loaf, but it's also a more difficult technique. So just it's muscle memory. You just got to, you know, get used to it and kind of learn to let your dough speak to you. But throwing a little bit of flour on the work surface is fine. So I'll lay the dough out onto a work surface, and I won't press it down. I'm not trying to degas it here. Okay, I'm just trying to handle it very, very gently. I want to keep that gas within the dough, because that's going to give me a superior flavor and also a superior oven spring. If you press all that gas out at this point, then you're going to deflate your loaf, which is exactly what you don't want to do, right? All these other bread books, they tell you, like, you know, degas your dough, like, you know, press it down. No. Be nice to your dough. Leave it alone. So you're going to do a stretch and fold, which means you're going to take the top corner of the dough, or the top edge that's the furthest away from you, and you're going to stretch it in to the middle of the dough. Then you're going to take the bottom edge that's closest to you, and you're going to stretch that into the middle of the dough. So you're basically folding it in thirds, just like you were folding up like a letter to mail. Then you take the left side, you fold that into the middle. You take the right side, you fold that into the middle. Now you have a seam that you've created, right? A very loose seam. So you're going to take the dough, you're going to flip it seam side down onto your work surface. And then with a couple of rapid cupping motions, you're going to kind of form it into a boule or a round piece of dough. Now place a piece of plastic wrap over the top of that and walk away for 20 minutes. Come back 20 minutes later, you're going to flip the dough seam side up. You're going to stretch the top half into the middle, stretch the bottom half into the middle, left side, right side, complete another stretch and fold. Flip it again seam side down, do some cupping motions, round off the dough, cover with plastic wrap, come back 20 minutes later for your third and final stretch and fold. Now, at this point, you should notice that the dough has really formed a beautiful gluten structure, right? It's kind of taut and it's full of life, and you can tell that it's really holding in the gas and it's jiggling around, right? So you do your final stretch and fold. And now, at this point, you're 3 hours into the process, a 2 hour autolyse and 1 hour of stretch and fold. Now, that's 3 hours total. Hey, I can do math. which means that you're getting pretty close to the point where you want to form the dough and actually let it proof. Now, this is a sort of a timing thing. This is you getting to know your environment and getting to know your starter. Sometimes you'll need that extra hour of fermentation, of the bulk fermentation. Sometimes you'll want to proof it immediately. Now, I can't really tell you without looking at your dough and being by your side. All I can say is that if the dough at this point has grown to, you know, it's starting to approach 2 times its original volume, then it's time to actually form it. If it's lively, but it just doesn't feel like it's totally full of life, it doesn't feel like it's bursting at the seams with gas, then you want to, after that third and final stretch and fold, you want to allow it to bulk ferment for another hour, okay, using this formula. Come back at the end of that hour. You're going to flip it seam side up again, and this time you're going to just kind of pull each edge, top, bottom, left, right, into the center, and you're going to pinch it together, forming a strong seam with your fingertips. Now, if you're using flour on your work surface, it's really important to make sure that you don't get any flour into the seam as you're pinching it off, because the seam won't fully seal. And what that means is you're going to have a weak seam, and you're going to have blowouts in your loaf. It's not going to, when you bake it, it's not going to expand how you want it to. So make sure there's no flour within that seam, and you want to just pinch it together so it's nice and tight. Okay, now you're going to flip the round loaf seam side down onto your work surface, and you're going to do what's called a tension pull. So imagine the loaf is sitting in front of you in the center of your work surface, and you're going to cup your hands around the backside of that loaf, just like you're giving somebody a hug, making a cupping motion where the bottoms of your hands are slightly tilted toward you and towards the dough. You're going to pull or drag that loaf towards you, almost in a semicircular motion. So instead of pulling it straight towards you, you're going to just kind of pull it in a circular motion towards you, almost like if you envision it being at 12 o'clock, at the top of the clock, right? You're going to do a tension pull where you pull the loaf of bread all the way around down to 6 o'clock, right, towards you. So you have, you know, so you're making that pull down to 6 o'clock following the curvature of that clock. And what this is going to do is it's going to pull the exterior or the top portion of the dough taut, and it's going to tighten that gluten structure to give you some, you give your bread some structure during the final rise. And you're going to do a few of these cupping motions where you do a tension pull towards you, tension pull towards you. And because the seam of your dough is on the bottom, as you pull that dough toward you, it's going to help to seal that seam as well while creating that tension. Now, it's important to note that you don't want any flour on your work surface when you're doing this. You want that tacky contact with your work surface that's going to create that tension, because if your dough slides too easily, if you have oil on this work surface, or if you have flour on the work surface, your dough is going to glide over that work surface, and you're not going to create that tension needed to close that seam and create that nice tension pull on the top. Now, at this point, what you want to do is, once you've done a couple of cupping motions and you have a nice tight piece of dough, but still being careful not to manhandle it, because you don't want all the gas to get pushed out at this point, I'm going to cover the dough, or you're going to cover the dough with plastic wrap, just loosely, just drape it over the top, and this is to keep it from drying out. Come back 10 minutes later, and you'll notice that the dough has relaxed a little bit. It's kind of starting to flatten out on you. So at this point, you're going to do another tension pull. Again, cover with plastic wrap, come back 10 minutes later, and look at it. If it's still kind of blobby and it's flattened out on you, then do a third and final tension pull, and that should do it. That should do the trick. Now, at this point, you have a well-shaped loaf of bread. Now, again, watch the video that's linked in the show notes, because the tension pull is a lot easier to show than explain. And you're going to take this loaf of bread, and you're going to flip it seam side up into a bowl that's lined with a kitchen towel that's lint-free, that kind of fits the loaf snugly, and you've dusted that kitchen towel with flour. Now, I like to use, in the videos I show you, that I'm using what's called a banneton, which is a proofing basket, and they're made of wicker that's woven together. You can use one with a cloth or without a cloth. Now, I like to use a 50-50 mix of bread flour and rice flour, because this helps to keep the dough from sticking to the canvas, because the rice flour is a little more granular, but also the rice flour too, it gives almost like a shiny crust to the bread when it's finished baking, which is sort of a nice little visual touch. But really, it's there to keep it from sticking. So you dust your either your kitchen towel that you're using or your Banneton that you're using with a good amount of rice flour and bread flour mix. And then you're going to rest the dough or proof your loaves in this basket, seam side up. And you want to make sure you're covering it with a kitchen towel or a piece of plastic wrap during the proofing process so that way it doesn't dry out. Now, at about the anywhere from 1 to 3 hours, the bread's going to be finished proofing. But what you really want to be looking for is the visual cue of 1.5 times its original size. Now, when you're baking normal bread without sourdough starter, you can take this a little bit further. You can do anywhere from 1.5 to 2 times its original volume. But when you start approaching that 2 times or the double volume point for a sourdough loaf that's proofing, you're getting into the territory of overproofed. And when that happens, you're just going to have a dense loaf of bread, which is kind of a bummer. So play it safe. Proof the bread till it's about 1.5 times its original volume, and now it's time to bake. So during the proofing time, you want to have the foresight to turn on your oven, obviously, so it's nice and hot. And you want to preheat in your oven a cast iron Dutch oven with a lid. And this is the important part. This is how you recreate that nice hearth oven like we were talking about at the beginning of this episode. So you take a cast iron Dutch oven or an enameled Dutch oven, and you want it to be at least a 6-quart. I use in the video, I believe the one I use in the video is a 9-quart. It's a little bit bigger, but a 6-quart will work for most applications. And you want to place this in your oven while you're preheating it. And you want to preheat for a good, you know, I mean, once your oven reaches 500 degrees, which is what you're going to preheat your oven to, once it reaches 500 degrees, you want to continue to let it heat the cast iron Dutch oven for about another 20 to 30 minutes. So what I do is when I do my final forming and I allow my dough to start proofing, then I turn my oven on and I throw my cast iron Dutch oven in there to heat up with the oven so it's nice and hot when I'm ready to bake. Now, when you're ready to bake your loaf of bread, you take the preheated cast iron Dutch oven and lid out of the oven, place it on your stovetop, very carefully remove the lid because it's hot, okay? It's cast iron in a 500-degree oven. It will burn you, all right? I know from experience. It doesn't feel very good. Remember, we were proofing that loaf of bread seam side up. So you want to very carefully flip it out into your hand. And watch how I do this in the video. I'm very gentle with it because if you flip too vigorously, it's going to collapse the dough underneath its own weight, which is going to affect your oven spring and give you a dense loaf. So very carefully flip that bread into your hand, seam side down, and lower it into the cast iron Dutch oven. So you're placing the loaf of bread in the Dutch oven, seam side down. Now, when I'm wearing my chef jacket, I like to make sure my sleeves are rolled all the way down because if I do accidentally touch the inside of the Dutch oven while I'm gently lowering the bread in there, I won't get burned. In this case, you might want to make sure you have long sleeves on or an oven mitt, but an oven mitt is a bit arduous. You know, it's going to be harder to handle the dough. At any rate, just try not to burn yourself. Place it seam side down in the cast iron Dutch oven, and then you want to score the top. Now, because this is a boule or a round loaf, you're going to do scoring or docking marks at 90-degree angles with a sharp knife or a razor blade, what we call a lame. And you want to cut in about 1/8 inch to 1/4 inch deep. And you just score it aggressively. Just do a nice X pattern on the top. Place the lid on top of the cast iron Dutch oven and place it back into your 500-degree oven. Now, what this does is as the bread starts to bake, the moisture in the dough turns to steam, and the lid in the Dutch oven traps the steam, which is extremely important for oven expansion or oven spring. But more importantly is the crust that it forms, that nice crackly crust that you get from a beautifully baked artisan loaf of bread that comes from a hearth oven or professional oven can only be formed in the presence of steam. So you want to bake with the lid on at 500 degrees. Now, it sounds hot, and it is, but remember, because of the pH in your bread dough, in your sourdough, it's not going to brown as fast as a lower pH bread, or excuse me, a higher pH bread that doesn't use sourdough. But also, too, the steam environment is going to create a moist environment with that lid on, so it's going to not really allow the bread to brown that quickly anyways. So you want to bake with the lid on for the first 15 to 30 minutes, and this is kind of more personal preference than anything. At the very least, you want to bake for the first 15 minutes because it's going to make sure that you have enough steam saturation in your oven to create that crust and to also facilitate a good oven spring. Now, I like to bake with a lid on for the first 30 minutes because what this does is it extends the steaming period, which I believe helps to form the crust and it helps to replicate more like the wood fire oven that I use at the restaurant. You know, we just seal that sucker up with a door and we don't ever vent it. And as the steam dissipates, the crust slowly starts to form over time. So I believe that keeping the lid on for the first 30 minutes will actually yield better results. But that's just me speaking anecdotally from some tests I've done. And so what you want to do is after the 30-minute mark, pull the lid off the Dutch oven, place the Dutch oven back in your oven, and then lower the temperature to about 400 to 425. And this depends on, you know, your oven, how hot it runs. And you're going to bake for an additional 20 to maybe 30 minutes or until the exterior of the crust is a dark, beautiful gradient of golden brown. And you want to really flirt with burning here. You don't want to burn your dough, but don't be scared. I mean, you'll see in the video, I take it really far, and those dark brown bits, they're really flirting with burnt. But that's how you get a nice complexity of flavor in your dough. You want to have everything from that light golden brown in your crust all the way to that very dark brown color that has a bit of a char or bitter flavor to it that's going to match beautifully with the crumb. Now, after your bread is finished baking, now, how do you know it's finished? Well, that's a good question. You want to remove it. And so at the 50-minute mark, so 30 minutes of steam, 20 minutes of reduced heat, the bread should be pretty close to done. And you're going to basically look at the color of your loaf. When you're happy with the color, I guarantee you it's pretty much going to be done. But to be sure, what you can do is place the bread in your hand. You know, you want to use an oven mitt for this, or just line your hand with a kitchen towel and thump the bottom of the bread with your thumb. Just give it a little thump, thump, thump. And if it sounds hollow, then you know the bread is fully baked, right? If the bread feels heavy in your hand for its size, you know that you have a denser loaf. Not all the water has evaporated yet, so you want to probably bake it for a little bit longer. Now, also, too, I know you're excited, but put that knife down, okay? Don't be cutting into your bread while it's still warm. Bread is really nothing more than a starch gel. And for that starch gel to fully set, it has to cool off, and you have to let it cool to room temperature. If you cut into it too early, all that steam is going to evacuate out of the loaf, and it's going to just give you a poor crumb. It's going to give you a gummy texture. The gel will never actually set properly. So be patient. You worked real hard to get to this point. Don't ruin it now by cutting the bread open prematurely. So place it on a wire rack and allow it to cool. Now, if you've baked the bread properly, and you've baked it in a really high oven, right, the bread will be so happy. It'll sing, right? You'll hear the bread song sing. And it goes, bread, 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 bread. Okay, just kidding. But there is actually a legitimate bread song. And that is, you can actually hear the crust crackle. And it'll pop at you. And that's the crust settling. And if you bake multiple loaves of bread at the same time, you can actually, it's not hard to hear. It'll actually sing to you. You can hear it crackling and settling as it cools off. Now, standard rule of thumb, the longer it takes for your crust to cool off, the longer your bread will last because the crust will be more sturdy. So at Stella, what we do is we actually like to cool off the bread right next to each other. So we have these wire bread baskets, and we kind of just stand the bread up on end and we shingle them next to each other. And as they cool off, they sing us their little bread song, and we hear them crackling and popping, and they cool. And we always try and bake our bread at around 4 o'clock because we open for dinner service at 5:30. So we have the bread out of the oven at about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and so it's dropping to room temperature right when our first guests arrive. And that's really when bread is at its best, is when it's at room temperature about anywhere from 4 to 8 hours after being baked. Now, because a finished loaf of sourdough does have a lower pH, it's actually a lot more shelf-stable than that sliced cake crap that you... Oh, did I say crap? It's that a sliced cake stuff that you get at the supermarket. Do you know why they call it Wonder Bread, by the way? Because it's a wonder anyone would actually eat it. I'm sorry. I'm just full of bad jokes today. So, yeah, regardless of my horrible jokes, your sourdough bread will actually last longer at room temperature. It won't go stale. So you're not going to need a bunch of dough conditioners or anti-staling agents added to your bread to keep it fresh. Now, once you actually slice into your bread, you want to place it in plastic wrap or in a large Ziploc bag, because you don't have those dough stabilizers in it, it will dry out. Once that interior crumb is exposed to air, it'll dry out rather quickly and go stale. Now, what will happen, because you're placing the leftover bread that you hadn't eaten in plastic wrap, some of that, the moisture in the crumb is going to migrate back out into the crust, softening that crust. So if you want to bring that crust back, you can just pop it back into your oven. I like to just wrap it in some tin foil, pop it in like a 375 degree oven for about 15 minutes, and you should be good to go. Now, this sourdough bread actually freezes really well too. So you want to cool it completely to room temperature and then wrap it tightly in plastic wrap and then tin foil, and then place this in your freezer, and you can freeze it for a few months. And then when you want to bring it back, the best way to actually bring back the bread is just the day before you're going to use it, pull it out and just let it sit on your counter at room temperature. Remove the foil and plastic wrap, because you don't want the plastic wrap to melt in your oven. And then pop the whole loaf that's already pretty much thawed out back in your oven at about 325, 350, 375, depending upon your oven. And you're just kind of trying to warm it through and then crisp that crust. And it actually comes back really, really well. Because what happens is, again, bread is a starch gel. So the starch almost starts to crystallize and it soaks up all the water around it. And that's what actually makes bread taste stale. When you heat bread, the moisture is migrated back into the loaf and kind of released, which gives it a fresh texture and fresh flavor. So reheating the sourdough loaf or any bread in general is kind of an important part when it gets a little bit older, to hide the fact that it's old. That's also too why when you go to restaurants, they serve you warm bread. It's not because they care about you, it's because their bread is stale and it's been hanging around for a few days. Unless you come to Stella, of course, and you know, we serve it to you at room temperature. And when people complain that it's not warm, we tell them to leave. No, we tell them why we don't serve it warm, and we happily heat up a slice for them if they are so inclined for that. So that's how you store your bread for long term and bring it back in your freezer, so you can make a couple of loaves ahead of time. What would my contribution be? Most definitely political, subliminal, partially, hardly any filler at that about the process. I'm thinking progress over literary garbage. Harness these words if they mean the future set. I'll be back even when dealing with the corporate structure. Power is given up to those. So your homework for this episode is to, surprise, surprise, make our basic loaf of sourdough bread. Now, remember, you're not going to knock it out of the park on your first try, but if you follow what I said in this audio lecture, if you listen to our other audio lectures and you watch our video carefully and you kind of take note of what I'm doing, you're going to get pretty dang close the first time around. And then any issues you have with how it turns out, that's what the Stella Culinary Forum is all for, right? So just go over to stellaculinary.com/forum. Register for a free username if you haven't yet, and then go ahead and post your question, and I'd be more than happy to answer it. And we also have some fun bread geeks over there too that can help answer your questions. And you know, you look and you see these people come to the forum, and they ask a question about the bread, and I give them a little bit of advice here. I say, hey, tweak this there, and after a couple of tries, like, they have that breakthrough moment. And it's always so exciting to see. You know, they start off making sourdough that they're not completely happy with, but they're not going to give up, and they dedicate themselves to doing it. And after like four, maybe five times of tweaking the recipe each time, and each time it getting better, then they have that like aha moment. It's always so magical to see. It's like, congratulations, man. You just made your first awesome loaf of sourdough bread. I mean, how good does that feel? It feels amazing. So that's what the Stella Culinary Forum is there for. So in today's Q&A segment, because I took way too long to record this podcast, which I apologize for. Actually, I just want to read you an email, because I usually pull comments from, or excuse me, questions for the podcast from, emails that get sent to me, but I've answered those long ago. So, But I had this really cool email sent to me by David. And David says, my 8-year-old son and I enjoy your podcast driving to and from school, where it takes us almost 30 minutes to get there. And believe it or not, I use your podcast as a reward for after he finishes his homework. Now, could you imagine that? That's kind of cruel, David. I mean, he does his homework and he has to listen to me geek out about lactic acid bacteria for God knows how long at this point. Jeez, this episode went really long. Now, if only I could get him to try and enjoy more food, he would have a shot at being a great chef. He prefers chicken strips over just about anything else still, but maybe one day. Well, look it. You know, it's funny. Well, so first of all, I want to give a shout out to Thomas, who's David's son. So Thomas, if you're listening, good job, buddy, with, listening to these podcasts. I can't believe you actually can make it through a whole one of these. But I'll tell you what, man, if you want to be a chef someday, I'm not going to sugarcoat this for you. It is hard work. It is really hard work. And if you think school's hard, being a chef is like 10 times harder. But also, too, you don't have to answer to teachers when you're the chef, because when you're the chef, you're the boss. But you start off, you know, dishwasher, line cook, you got to work your way up. It's a real tough business. But what allows you to advance is education and knowledge. And that's the most important thing. So the more you learn, the more you know, the faster you will advance in this industry. So if your dream is to be a chef someday, then you can achieve it. And if I do say so myself, the Stella Culinary School podcasts are a pretty dang good way to start. But also, too, you got to start developing your palate, bro. You know, you can't just be eating chicken fingers all the time. You got to figure out what other stuff tastes like. But it's funny. I have my daughter. She's going to be, you know, 5 in October. And she loves nothing more than to help me cook in the kitchen. She's always, you know, up on her stool helping me stir stuff. I got her little plastic lettuce knife that she does, you know, that I use to chop. Yeah, can you believe it, guys? Jacob Burton, you know, me, I bought a lettuce knife. Yeah, well, it's a great way to allow your kid to feel like they're chopping something without, you know, worrying about taking them to the ER. So yeah, I went out, I got her a little plastic lettuce knife, and she, you know, chops up some salad for the dinner, or she'll help me stir something. She'll help me, you know, she'll do the whole whisking motion while I drizzle in some oil to make a vinaigrette. And she's totally, totally into it until I'm like, hey, Lila, you know, stick your finger in that vinaigrette and give it a little taste. She's like, nope, not going to happen, Dad. Nope. She loves chicken fingers too. And it is like pulling teeth to get her to try new things. But I figure, you know, if you expose them to good food enough, then hopefully they'll eventually naturally grow out of it. So, but look, if you're a parent and you have a picky kid and you can't get them to eat your stuff, don't take it personally, because, I mean, hell, if anyone knows how to cook, I know how to cook, and I can't get my kid to eat anything besides like chicken and rice and pasta. So I started bribing her with like stars. So we give her like a star every time she eats something that's actually, you know, good, wholesome food. And it actually worked for a couple of days until she discovered that, wait a second, these stars don't mean anything and I still hate broccoli. So, you know, we do what we can. Now, before we finish up here, I do have a quick announcement. I know we went long, so I'm going to make this announcement really quick. I actually want to spend more time on this subject with you in the announcement segment, because I'm really excited about something that's going on with me professionally right now. But I just don't – I already went so dang long in this podcast episode. Maybe we'll have to save it for another time. But I wanted to give you guys a heads up, and the heads up is this. So I developed a proprietary curriculum that's awesome. It's called the F-Step Curriculum. It stands for Flavor, Sauce, Technique, Execution, Preparation. And it's not only the system in which I wish I was taught how to cook, but it's also a creative process that teaches people how to create their own dishes. And I made this curriculum for our culinary boot camp that we do once a year at Stella. And we accept 12 students. We close down the restaurant for a week. And people fly in from all over the place to take our boot camp. Now, the problem is first of all, the boot camp is really expensive, but it's worth it, in my opinion. And in the students' opinion, it's worth it. It's $2,200 for the week, and we're probably actually going to raise the price this year just because it's we can, to be completely honest with you, because it's in such high demand. And last year, our boot camp sold out in less than 23 hours, right? We had 12 slots only. We sent it out to our waiting list of 250 people. So the normal Stella Culinary email newsletter list has about, at this point, of recording this this podcast, we have about 7,800 total. So the 7,800 people didn't even actually get a crack at last year's boot camp because we have a waiting list of like 230 plus that we sent an early notification to, and they took up all the slots in less than 24 hours. So what I did this year, because it's almost at this point, it's almost impossible to get into our boot camp because we're just really not willing to shut down the restaurant more than once a year for this boot camp. I recorded all the video lectures at this year's boot camp because a big portion of what we do at the boot camp is I walk you through this F-step curriculum. And because there's five steps of the F-step process, then each day is one step and we do it in order. So, you know, day one is flavor, day two is sauce, day three is technique. And I bring you through this curriculum with a morning lecture of about, you know, 1.5 to 2 hours. And then we do an afternoon lecture where we kind of follow up on some methods. And we talk about the F-step process, which is a creative process. And the whole point of this curriculum is you already know, honestly, if you've been with me since the beginning and you've worked your way through all these podcasts and you watch all my videos online, besides a few small gaps, you're pretty much looking at the first year of culinary school online for free. Straight up, stocks, mother sauces, cooking techniques. Really, I mean, it's been a long time in the works, but it's almost the first year of culinary school online for free for anyone to just go and check out. Now, honestly, it would probably be more helpful if I structured it a little bit better just because there's so much content at this point, it kind of gets confusing where to start at, which I have plans for that in the future. But the whole purpose behind the F-step process is I'm like, well, if I've already given them the first year of culinary school for free and they're paying me $2,200 to spend a week with me, like how am I going to blow their minds? Like how am I going to really make it worth their while? So I created the F-step curriculum, which is there to sort of push that reset button in your brain and teach you how to think like a professional chef, teach you how to create like a professional chef, stop being encumbered by having to follow other people's recipes, understand the basic building blocks of what makes a recipe good or bad, and then create your own recipe by having a deep understanding of flavor structure, by having a deep understanding of technique. And that's really what a recipe is, right? We actually have a formula called the F-step formula, and it's flavor structure plus technique in parentheses times execution. And that'll explain any dish that you've ever made or ever will make, right? You have your flavor structure, you have your technique. If your flavor structure is solid and your technique is solid, then you have the makings of a great dish. But if you can't execute it, which is one of our lectures that I talk about is execution, which is very important, then that dish that you can't execute is just going to suck no matter what you do. So why am I telling you this? Well, I'm going to be releasing this as a online curriculum. And what's cool about it is the curriculum is so dense. I mean, the written curriculum itself is about 50,000 words. And we're not talking recipes here. We're talking 50,000 words of curriculum on, you know, flavor, on sauces, why the five French mother sauces are redundant and out of date and why you shouldn't use them and why I have a much better way to learn sauces. And the curriculum is so dense that it's hard to get through it in the 5 days that the students are with me at boot camp. And beyond the curriculum, I also have some cool bonuses planned to help really showcase the concepts in the curriculum. So that's going to be available online soon. And that's also why I've been, you know, I've had my head down real busy working for like the last 8 months on this. The curriculum took me about 2 years to develop. In the last 8 months, I've been working on editing all the videos into bite-sized chunks, converting them into audio lectures so you can take them with you on the go as well, editing down the written curriculum, and also building classrooms around this stuff. So when you go on, it's actually going to be like a real like online course that you can take, and it's going to be awesome, really, in my opinion. It's going to be great. I mean, it's really going to, if you're serious about taking your cooking to the next level, if you're serious about being a professional chef or just cooking like a professional chef, and you really want to learn how to create amazing recipes, create your own recipes, and how to execute those for, you know, for one person, for 10 people, for 20 people, then honestly, I mean, not to overblow this, but I mean, because you know me, I mean, straight up, like I've been doing this for a long time as far as, you know, doing the podcast, doing the websites. I'm not one to blow smoke up your apron, okay? But I'm real excited about this this online curriculum. It's going to be really, really awesome. It's been a ton of hard work and it's almost done. It's almost come to full fruition. So if you're interested in that, just make sure you're on our email newsletter list because that's how you're going to find out once it's released. And to make sure it's like a real classroom environment, You know, we're going to have a private student-only forum that I'm going to heavily monitor to, you know, answer your questions on whether it's, you know, cooking a recipe or a technique, or even if you, you know, are just any general cooking questions or professional cooking questions that you have, I'll be there on the forum to answer them for you. So to keep that manageable, I'm going to limit the registration. What I'm going to do is I'm just going to open registration for a week, because when you limit it by number, people tend to get frustrated. And because I don't have to do that online, I have to do that with my boot camp, because I can only physically fit 12 people in my class. So I'm going to open it up for a week. And so you're going to get an email and basically say, hey, you know, and you're going to have a lot more information to read over first before you register for this course. So you'll get shot to a page where you can read about all the different information in the course. You can read through all the different things that the course is going to teach you. And then you're going to have a week to sign up for that. And then I'll close the registration at the end of the week. And then we'll get started. And it's going to be a ton of fun. And I'll admit, too, that straight up, this course is not going to be for everybody. It's a pretty intensive course, a lot of really dense information. So it's really only for people who really want to take their cooking to the next level. So if you just kind of want to hang back and you just kind of like, you know, you like watching some of my videos and like listening to some of my podcasts, that's cool, too. And I have a lot more videos and podcasts planned for you in the coming months. But just so you know, the next probably 3 months, I'll be focusing on getting the online bootcamp and F-Step curriculum launched, and then focusing on those students who are going through that curriculum to make sure they're getting the most out of it. And then you'll probably see me pop my head back up at the end of summer, taking a few deep breaths, and then you know, shooting off some videos and some audio podcasts. And that's it for this episode of the Stella Culinary School Podcast. Thank you so much for joining me and making it through this extra long podcast episode. If you have any questions or comments, or you need more information like the video on our sourdough bread, then head on over to this episode's show notes, where you'll find all of it at stellaculinary.com/SES22. Until next time, this is Jacob Burton with the Stella Culinary School Podcast, reminding you to cook with passion.